The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has four matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040427, State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company versus Teresa Nickerson from Lamar County and the 6th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 040514, State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company versus Jimmy R. Norris from Limestone County and the 10th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 040537, Lilith Brainerd versus Trinity Universal Insurance Company versus from Gray County in the 7th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 040570, GTE MobileNet of Houston, Inc. versus the Chair King from Harris County in the 14th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 15 minutes per side in the first three matters and 20 minutes per side in the last. The court will take a brief recess between each argument. Justice Hecht is sitting in each of these matters, but is currently at a Federal Rules Advisory Committee meeting in Washington, D.C. Justice O'Neill is not sitting in the first three matters, and Justice Johnson is not sitting in 040537, the Brainerd case. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. The court is ready to hear argument in 040427, State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company versus Teresa Nickerson.
May it please the court, Mr. Cooper will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, the sole issue in this case is whether Chapter 38 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code allows recovery of attorney's fees by an insured prior to the time the uninsured motorist carrier has an obligation to pay the damages. Now, the starting point, we believe, for this court's analysis is under Chapter 38. And as this court is well aware, a few years ago, in Grapevine Excavating versus Maryland Lloyds, this court held a couple things. One is this court held that Chapter 38 does apply to insurance contracts. But number two, importantly, I think, with respect to this case, this court held that under Chapter 38, in order to recover the attorney's fees, that it was incumbent upon the insured to show that there had been a breach of contract on the part of the insured. Now, the question in this case is, was the underlying suit one for breach of contract? The uninsured motorist policy, which was issued by State Farm in this case, was the one that is prescribed by the Texas Department of Insurance. And essentially, it requires that State Farm to pay damages which a covered person is, and here's the key terms, legally entitled to recover from the owner or operator of an uninsured motor vehicle. Now, in this case, the question is, when was there a duty to pay on State Farm, and at what point in time did Nickerson become legally entitled to recover damages from Christopher? And we believe the controlling case with respect to our case is this court's decision in the Henson case. And there were three pronouncements from this court in Henson which we feel control the disposition of this case. First, this court in Henson, and again, Henson involved, as the court is well aware, creatures in interest, not attorney's fees, but the whole issue was, when was there a duty to pay and when would there be a breach of contract? In Henson, this court said three things. One, it says, neither of these events, the claim itself or the filing of the suit, triggers an obligation on the part of the uninsured motorist carrier to pay. This court went on to say that when the jury found Contreras, in this case, the uninsured motorist, at fault for the accident and found Henson damaged by her negligence, Henson became legally entitled to recover from Contreras. That is, The first point in time in which there was a legal entitlement recovered was when the jury found that the uninsured motorist was liable to the insured, Henson, in that case. In
Mr. Cooper, is the approach that you're asking this court to follow different for UIM and UM coverages for insurance contracts compared to other contracts under Chapter 38?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Because with respect to all other contracts, in order to recover under Chapter 38, there must be an obligation to pay on that contract. You must be suing for a breach of contract before you can get attorney's fees. And here, we're saying that you shouldn't be able to get attorney's fees with respect to an uninsured motorist contract until there is a right to recover under the contract.
For contracts outside this context, so long as there's proper presentment, then you get attorney's fees going back to that date, even though there may be a later trial on whether the breach actually occurred and what the amount of damages for that breach is.
But
here you're saying the attorney's fees shouldn't accrue until after the jury verdict or the judgment.
Correct.
Why is that not different from other contracts? And if it is, why should we follow a different rule here?
Well, first off, we're not asking you to follow a different rule. We're asking the court to follow what it said in Henson. But second, in these other cases where you say there was a presentment, at the time of the presentment, there was a mature claim. And if you look at Chapter 38.0...
So is the issue a mature claim or is it legal entitlement to pay?
Well, actually, if
when
you look
a party
at
presents a breach of contract claim and the amount they think they're owed, if there's a dispute there, you'd be hard-pressed to say there's a legal entitlement to pay until after the trial or after a legal determination. Here you're saying there should be a verdict or a judgment, and that's when the legal entitlement to pay arises. So is it a mature claim or is it legal entitlement? What's the test?
Well, it depends upon the nature of the contract. I would mean, for example, if I owed Mr. Nickerson here $100 and it was a note suit, and the note was past due and he sued me, there would be an entitlement to recover those attorney's fees because the claim was mature, even though there was no legal entitlement to pay. The issue on legal entitlement to pay is the condition preceding that the State Board of Insurance has placed in the uninsured motorist contracts in the state of Texas. And the court, the State Board of Insurance, we believe, as well as this court has said, that the obligation to pay, that there is no right to receive payment until this condition has been met. And that is part of the terms of the contract that was entered into between the insured and the insurer in this case. Also, you go to Chapter 38.002 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which is the governing statute which this suit was brought under. There are three elements. The first two really don't apply in this case. Well, they do apply, but they're not in dispute. It's the third one which is in dispute, which is that to recover attorney's fees under this chapter, it must be for payment for the just amount owed, which must not have been tendered before the expiration of the 30th day of the claim presented. And you look at the cases interpreting 38.002, particularly the phrase just amount owed, and the courts, whether it's insurance, whether it's other contexts, have said that means there was a legal entitlement to those damages. For example,
So legally entitled is the same as just amount owed.
There have been at least three courts of appeals who have said that that is the case. The Austin Court, the 14th Court, and the Eastland Court have said that they are the same. That is, that all conditions preceded have been satisfied and that there is a current legal obligation to receive those funds. That is correct. Now, if you look in this case, following the Henson, and again, the last holding in Henson, which I think is important, is this court said, by the terms of the policy, no obligation to pay the claim existed under the UM policy until the jury established the uninsured motorist liability. And the insurers paid the claim promptly after the jury made its finding because no contractual duty was breached. Henson had no right to receive the benefits earlier than he in fact received them. So this court in Henson said, until the jury returned their verdict, there was no breach of contract.
I see. So you're not asking for, if I understand what you're arguing correctly, a different application of Chapter 38 for these types of contracts. You're saying if you look at the language of the contract and then apply Chapter 38 to it, there must be, under the language of the contract, a legal entitlement to recover before a breach can occur.
That is correct. That's what this court held, we believe. Well, it did hold in the Henson case. It is
Henson,
a condition precedent. I'm sorry?
Henson did not address attorney's fees.
That is absolutely correct. It addressed.
And Chapter 38 talks about presentment of the claim, right?
Well, Chapter 38.001 says a person may recover reasonable attorney's fees from an individual or corporation in addition to the amount of a, and the key terms are, valid claim. That is, you have a valid claim. You go to 38.002, it does address the presentment of the claim. It requires it to be presented, but it also says that the payment for the just amount due must not have been made within 30 days after presentment of a claim for a just amount due. And again, you look at cases under Chapter 38.002, they have determined just amount due to mean you have a present right to receive the money. This court has addressed in the past issues regarding conditions preceding. The Lenz case, this court said that Lenz versus, or Dillon versus Lenz, that where a promise to pay is made subject to a condition preceding, no breach of contract occurs until the condition occurs. And following this court's holding in Lenz, also in Henson, there was no obligation to pay until there had been a determination by the jury that Ms. Nickerson was legally entitled to recover from the uninsured motorist.
Is there a way to read the Chapter 38 as a legislative policy to encourage the prompt payment of claims so that once the claim is presented, it's resolved quickly by the company rather than delay until after trial?
I don't think that legislative policy, Your Honor, is expressed in Chapter 38 for this reason. If you go to Chapter 38.006, it says basically if you can get attorney's fees under another section, you don't get it under Chapter 38. One of the other sections that's referred to is Article 21.21 of the Insurance Code, which this contract would be subject to. And within Article 21.21, there is the legislative intent regarding prompt payment of claims under Section 4, Subsection 10, the Prompt Payment of Claims Act, that it was, and I'm sorry, it's not 2121 anymore, it's Section 421 or 422 of the Insurance Code. The legislature is trying to confuse us all by renumbering all the statutes, even though they are the same, but I think most of us know it by Article 21.21. But, Your Honor, I believe even if that was the case, there still is encouragement to pay the claims promptly, because once that determination has been made, there's every incentive on the part of an insurance company to pay it within 30 days, or the insurance company will be subject to payment of attorney's fees. So I think if there is that legislative history, it's there.
Under your argument, you wouldn't finally become legally obligated to pay if there is an appeal, correct?
Well, this court...
Or if the judgment is superseded.
This court, and it would depend, frankly, if the case was against the underinsured motorist, which some of these cases are brought at, or if the uninsured motorist has settled and it's only brought against the uninsured motorist carrier. Now, this court... And Henson said it was the verdict that would trigger the obligation that there was a legal entitlement to recover.
Your logic would mean that that was wrong, that limitation was wrong, because there would not be, what if there's a reversal and rendition on appeal, for example?
Well, if there was a reversal and rendition on appeal, then obviously you wouldn't owe the money under the uninsured motorist.
But why would you owe it after the verdict when what you're arguing here is there's no legal obligation to pay until a verdict. But isn't it true that there's not a final determination of that legal obligation until either the deadline for perfecting an appeal has passed or there's a final determination by an appellate court?
It would be subject to the appellate rights of the parties. That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
Thank you. Are there any further?
Yeah, just to follow up, I take it you agree with the Chief's last comment, but that still begs the question. Agreeing with his last comment undermines your argument that legal entitlement to pay is the linchpin, because there is no legal entitlement to pay if the judgment is superseded on appeal.
Well,
or legal obligation to pay, I should say.
Well, this court, again, for the purposes of prejudgment interest, and I think the same rule could be engrafted with respect to the attorney's fees, has said that it was the verdict, for example, in the Henson case, which triggered the legal obligation to pay and triggered the prejudgment interest running. Obviously, if the
can you make sense of that, though, in light of your argument, or should we just disregard the reasoning and follow that case?
No, I think it can be reconciled.
How? Really,
okay. For this reason, that the insured has met their burden of showing the legal entitlement. Granted, it can be superseded. However, if the insurer, after that point in time, elects to go ahead and appeal and exercise their appellate rights, they would run the exposure to attorney's fees. And they would, I think, according to Henson, if you follow Henson, would still run the risk of being exposed to prejudgment interest after that point in time.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Nickerson, represents argument for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. I know there's an old adage that any lawyer that represents himself has got a fool for a client. I hope it doesn't apply to spouses, or I'm not going to be eating breakfast for 20 years. I kind of feel somewhat like the lawyer who walks into the courtroom and the other side introduces a 6-inch stack of medical records, pulls out one sentence, and represents that's all there is to this 6 inches of medical records. Well, that's usually not the truth, and I don't think the representations by Mr. Cooper in this case are either. The appellant misapplies Henderson in this case. It's distinguishable from this case. Number one, attorney's fees were not an issue. But number two, much of the Henson decision relating to a jury verdict being returned was based upon that the court considered the argument of counsel in their briefs to end up being a stipulation, and that the case flowed from that. And it really doesn't address the issue before the court, and it really has nothing to do with it. And in support of that, there is one case that was not in the briefs that was decided, I think, a week following the appellee's brief in this case, and that's Henry Teachers, cited at 2004 Westlaw 241-3311, which was decided on October 28, 2004. And the Amarillo Court, in which the Henson case originated, considered some of the issues in a mandamus action again. And the court said that in response to the insurer's argument that a claim under UIM was not right and did not accrue until such time as a third-party tortfeasor's liability and the amount of damages had been established by a trial, the court did not consider Henson to control the issue then before it in response to that claim. The court went further and said that whatever the merits of the insurer's argument in that case had been foreclosed by the Supreme Court in its Matlock decision, which is quoted in the brief, and the Franco decision. In Matlock, this court held, in upholding a Texarkana court decision, that neither 501-1 of the insurance code nor the policy provisions of the standard Texas automobile policy required a UIM claimant to obtain a judgment against a third-party tortfeasor prior to obtaining a judgment against the insurer in response to State Farm's argument at that time that a judgment against the insured motorist was a condition preceding to the insured's action against the insurer. State Farm is back before this court.
But you've got, even if you don't sue the uninsured motorist, you've got to prove negligence.
And that's what happens. They misconstrued this case. It is a contract case. Just because a jury
didn't ask a contract question.
I'm sorry.
Didn't ask a contract question.
Well, it wasn't in dispute. Only the issues that are in dispute are submitted to the jury. And by the stipulation they've entered into, that all the requirements of 38.002 were stipulated to, what else can you ask for?
Let me ask you, the damages in this case were primarily for pain and mental anguish. right?
No.
Well, the jury wrote in $41,000, not that we give legal effect to that, but they did that next to the medical, right?
I can't remember that, but since I lived with her, I wouldn't agree with what the court
was saying. Well, what was most of the $225,000?
Disability that lasted over 10 years, in fact, is lasting today.
Disability in the sense of lost earning capacity or in the sense of
pain and suffering, injury to the body?
That's where I started. So it's, as I began, it's mostly pain and suffering. Are you aware of any contract claim for which you get pain and suffering damages?
UIM claim.
This is the only contract claim for which one gets a completely amorphous, unliquidated damage amount. So it's a little harder to pay off than any other contract claim, is it not?
Not any different than any other insurance.
Name one other contract claim. You don't get mental anguish from your property or casualty from your property insurer, for your PIP, for any other first party. This is the only contract claim where one gets completely unliquidated pain and anguish, right?
I agree with the court.
So it's a little harder to know how to pay it off, is it not?
Insurance companies evaluate pain and suffering claims every day under the liability portions of the policies. It seems strange to me that you have this policy, my wife buys, from State Farm. It has a provision for liability that you investigate, but you can't take the investigation from the liability portion and move it over to the UIM portion when you're the same company. It doesn't make sense not to do that, especially when the language is so much similar. And the real purpose of UIM is just an extension of what damages are recovered under liability.
So the way you see this, somebody's in a car accident. They've got, let's say, $20,000 in lost and hard damages, economic damages, lost earning capacity, lost property damage, medical expenses. But they ask for $100,000, or what's the rule of thumb? Three times actual. So they ask for another $60,000 for emotional anguish. Unless the insurance company in all cases pays that, they will pay attorney's fees on anything over $20,000?
Only if the insurance company is wrong and refuses to pay the just amount due.
Right, so they offer $25,000.
And if they're wrong, they're wrong. When they're right, they're right.
But on the other hand, if the policyholder is wrong, they pay no attorney's fees.
That's correct. Sure.
So what's going to be the effect of this rule? All UM is more expensive. So a few people can get not just unliquidated damages, but attorney's fees as well, with no risk to themselves.
Well, if this court decides that in the future that on liability policies that injured party cannot recover for pain and suffering,
well, in liability policies, you don't have a conflict with your client. Here you do.
With
your own client.
No.
I mean, here you're on opposite sides of this UM case, and every time the carrier is representing the person you're suing, in effect.
That's in effect what it is. But in this case, they not only are representing the person in that claim on the uninsured motorist. They've paid off for that underinsured motorist on their liability portion of his policy,
right,
which also happens to come from State Farm.
And it's a little different from the normal bad faith situation in that before we get to UM, the carrier has usually paid off its own insured for PIP, property damage, at least some amount of the actual economic damages.
I don't know what would be wrong with that.
We've got to construe this statute, though, for all uninsured motorist carriers, not for the peculiar situation where State Farm has to be on both sides.
Well, I think the court has. As I mentioned, the Franco and the
Matlock. But all we said in Matlock is you didn't have to go to judgment against the tortfeasor. You could settle with the tortfeasor, but we were very clear in Henson that before the UM obligation kicks into effect, you have to go to court and establish. If there's a dispute, you have to go into court and establish liability in the amount of damages before there's any obligation to pay under the UIM.
I don't read the case exactly the same way, Your Honor, but if you've got to go to court every time and get a judgment to go to the second step of the contract, we're going back and do this all over again. In fact, that's what's going to happen in this case. if the attorney's fees are reversed. What happened in this case is State Farm gets a judgment is rendered against State Farm, and they pay $190,000 approximately of the $300,000 judgment within 30 days. They wait until the day of the argument before the Court of Appeals and pay the remaining $110,000 to get up to $300,000. Well over a year.
Well, they may have some exposure from the date of judgment until the date they actually paid on attorney's fees, but assuming they had paid within 30 days.
Well, assuming that the Henson case was based upon the stipulation that the court considered to be as a result of the briefs in that case, which is what it reads like to me, the real time that you're legally entitled in which to recover amounts under a UIM claim is when the accident happens. The rest of it is just showing the UIM carrier how much the wherever there's liability, which can either be done by judgment admittedly, it can either be done by agreement of the parties, or it can be done by investigation to comply with their duties under 2155. Under 2155, they've got a duty to investigate within so many days of receipt of the claim. They've got so many days to accept or reject the claim, and they've got so many days.
But Henson would have come out a different way if we accepted your argument. Henson would have come out a different way because they had the duty to investigate in Henson. We said no, prejudgment interest doesn't accrue until they don't pay within 30 days after.
That's their interpretation of it, and again, I think that case is limited to its facts because of how the court arrived at its decision. You know, it's amazing to me you have Matlock decision, and you've got several courts of appeals that go one direction following the Matlock decision and the Franco decision, and you've got another set of court of appeals
but
going a different direction.
But they're apples and oranges. All we said in Matlock is you don't have to waive. You can go ahead and settle with the tortfeasor who doesn't have any money. You don't have to get a judgment against the tortfeasor. That doesn't mean that you do not have to establish in a court of law the tortfeasor's liability.
But the Franco decision does say what the insured has to do, and that is to show what the liability is and what the damages are. But the court didn't say to show what the damages are, that you have to show a certain debt or some certain, that it's more like an unliquidated claim in which you show enough facts for the insurer to determine what the damages are from the facts, more like an unliquidated damages claim.
Where does Texas what's the state of affairs nationally on UM and the responsibility for attorney's fees?
I'm not going to be able to answer the court truthfully on that nationally.
38.001 says a valid claim. That term. What does valid claim mean? If the insurance company, to use your example earlier, does its investigation and comes out with one amount for economic and non-economic damages, and the plaintiff comes up with a different number, which one is the valid claim and the valid amount or the just amount owed?
Well, you may not be able to figure out what the dispute between those two is later if the dispute continues.
Well, if we get a jury determination, that advances the ball quite a long ways down the road, doesn't it?
If you wait until then you might as well wipe out 2155. You might as well wipe out the common law, the duty to investigate under Giles versus Universe, on the common law duty to investigate. You might as well wipe out 2121 as far as UIM claims go.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I agree or not, but I'm just talking about Chapter 38. We'll get to 2155 later if we need to.
If the legislature wanted
to... What does valid claim mean under 38.001?
Valid claim...
If the parties disagree on the amounts, and they're going to when you have a trial. That's why you have a trial. You're saying there should be an obligation that kicks in at the time the party injured says... This is the amount they believe they're owed? Is that what you're saying?
I think that's when the claim accrues, is when the accident happens. You've got a contract that says this is what we'll do in the event of this situation that you were injured by an underinsured motorist.
Yeah. And in this type of a breach of contract claim, as you were just discussing with my colleague, we don't have just economic damages. They're non-economic damages, inherently difficult to determine. In a commercial contract, we're talking about economic damages, which are easier to determine. Could that be a reason why Chapter 38 in a contract, unlike UIM, where the obligation to pay only kicks in at a certain time under the contract terms, only involves damages that are easier to determine, as opposed to this situation where the damages are unliquidated and harder to determine before we can get to what is a valid claim under 38.001. Why is that reasoning not sensible?
But this court said that the valid claim is the unliquidated damages situation.
I'm sorry?
In the Franco case, this court said that it is more akin to the unliquidated claim than it is the strict interpretation of only a liquidated claim.
Well, let's put Franco to the side. Does it make sense? Let me ask you what makes sense.
Well, there's a lot of things that don't seem to make sense. For instance,
well, that's part of our job. That's right, to make sense.
Straighten it all out.
And not just in your case.
That's what we're here for, is to straighten it all out.
That's what your job is today.
Yes.
Makes sense. I mean, I don't know if I agree or disagree with your characterization of these other cases. I'm asking you, how does it make sense?
How does it make sense? It makes sense for somebody to pay a premium to an insurance company, and the insurance company says, here's what I'm selling you. I'm selling you this thing called UIM coverage because I've got to unless you wait. And I'm going to sell it to you in any amount that you want to pay for it. And in this case, it happens to be $300,000 instead of $10,000 or $50,000 or whatever. But that's what the agreement was. And it says that if I do have permission to continue on,
you may.
It says that contract says, here's what we're going to do in return for your money. We're going to pay you any damages that an underinsured motorist can't cover if he's liable. And then we're going to conduct an investigation under 2155 and 2121 and the duty to investigate under Universe versus Giles, which I think it's in footnote 4 or 5, that says we're going to investigate this and determine whether our insured is liable. We've got a right to control his defense. We're going to make that decision for him. We're going to decide whether he's liable or not. Not based upon what you tell us, but what we decide. And they do that. Then we get down to, okay, under the UIM, I might also be deciding we owe a lot more money than what we wanted to pay out. That's why it all makes sense. Because it's all in the contract.
Even in describing what you just described, you use the term, if liable, at least twice. Isn't that key? Determining if it's liable and in what amount?
But often the determination is made during the claims investigation, correct?
That's right.
The only issue is whether or not settlement is reasonable to the party controlling the purse strings.
And everybody takes their risk. If the plaintiff thinks it's unreasonable and loses,
Help me with this. I'm having trouble with this because this is a UM claim. And let's suppose, under your analysis, it seems to me that the insured, you're still in litigation with a third-party tortfeasor. You haven't settled. You've got a lawsuit ongoing. But under your theory, I can go to my insurance company and say, look, I'm going to beat this guy, and I'm going to show that he's uninsured. He's damaged me $1 million. He's only got $300,000 worth of coverage. So you pay me $1 million now before we ever go to trial. You've got a duty to investigate. You've got a duty to evaluate. And you've got a duty to decide whether you think he's uninsured or not and conclude that he is and pay me the money. So under your theory, the insurance company can be liable under the UIM policy while even before there's ever a judgment in an ongoing case against the third party.
I was assuming that getting a judgment is the only way to determine that. The UIM carrier can agree
The flip side of that is he's only got $25,000 worth of insurance. He's clearly judgment-proof. You settle with which the UIM carrier can't control whether its insured settles with a third party or at what amount.
In this case,
you settle at $25,000, and then you're saying then you have to accept the insured's word for it on what the damages would be if they'd gone to trial against the third party.
I've never seen an insurance company accept the word of a insured in 30 years. They may ask the insured for information.
But see, the duty is the same whether you settled or whether you're still pursuing tortfeasor. Your theory is the insurance company has this absolute standalone obligation regardless of the state of the proceedings against the tortfeasor.
Because they entered into a contract. That's what they said they would do in return for your money. You pay them your money, then they say, no, that's not what we said we would do.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr.
Mr. Cooper, if you're your economic medical expenses are $100,000. If you have a first party coverage that supplies up to $100,000, you've got to pay without lawsuit, damages, attorney's fees, prejudgment interest if you don't pay. Are you, under your theory, are you better off? You've still got $100,000 in hospital expenses, but if it's UM, you're going to have to rely on to collect it. No attorney's fees, no prejudgment interest runs until after judgment. Doesn't that give the insurer an incentive not to do anything?
No, Your Honor, for this reason. Let's assume it's a 100,000 UM policy and you've got 100,000 medicals. Medicals alone exceed the UM policy. You still have Article 2121 out there, if you commit bad faith, where you can get attorney's fees, or 2155, which is now 422 or whatever it is. If there is a situation where the damages are clearly owed, there is another remedy for the insured, and that's under 2121 or 2155. In this case, the Department of Insurance prescribed this form for a reason. Because, Justice Brewster, as you said, where you have economic damages, it is very difficult in certain cases to determine what is the amount that's owed. And you think about it, under Mr. Nickerson's scenario, let's assume it was a $300,000 UM policy and you had $5,000 in medicals and that was it. But they wanted the whole $300,000. And the insurance company says, we just don't see that that's reasonable in light of the evidence. Well, according to his theory, he's made a demand. He's made a presentment. You go to trial, and let's say it, you know, you've got experts and the whole nine yards, and they rack up $75,000 in attorney's fees, and the jury awards them $5,000. Well, the insurance company was right, but since there's been a presentment, he could still get the $75,000 under his theory because the insurance company exercised their right, which is conferred under the policy, to have a legal determination.
Alternatively, the jury says, well, it's just an insurance company that's the defendant. Let's do give them $300,000. Your argument is you don't get attorney's fees as well because even though it turns out the $300,000 demand was reasonable, it was not clear that we weren't clearly liable for it before the jury verdict.
What I'm saying is under Chapter 38, you would not get your attorney's fees if there is an egregious case. There are other statutes out there to provide relief to insurers. It's just not under Chapter 38. It's 2155 or 2120.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court is now to brief recess.